This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Penelope Cruz stars in Parallel Mothers, the new movie written and directed by Pedro Almodovar. I know I'm not alone in thinking he's one of the best working filmmakers in the world. Parallel Mothers is on a bunch of 10 best lists, including our film critics Justin Chang. It has a Golden Globe nomination for Best Foreign Language Film. Cruz was named this year's Best Actress by the LA Film Critics Association. She's at the emotional center of several Almodovar films, including All About My Mother, Volver, Broken Embraces, and Pain and Glory. She became the first Spanish actress to win an Oscar when she won Best Supporting Actress for her performance in the 2008 film Vicky Cristina Barcelona. She's also the first Spanish actress to have a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. The new film, Parallel Mothers, is set in Madrid and revolves around two women who accidentally became pregnant. Cruz plays Janice, a professional photographer around 40 years old, who's thrilled to be pregnant, although she's no longer with the father. Her roommate in the maternity wing is a teenager named Anna, who's filled with regret about having become pregnant. Their lives intertwine in increasingly surprising ways. In addition to telling the story of these two parallel mothers, the movie finds the parallels between the pain and necessity of being honest about your own past and about your country's dark past. Penelope Cruz, welcome to Fresh Air. I love this film. I love your performance in it and your performance in so many other films as well. So thank you for coming on our show.
Thank you so much.
You have two children. What did you discuss with Almodovar about how to portray the birth scene at the beginning of the film, which is such an important scene that kind of sets the tone for the rest of the film?
Well, we discussed a lot about it because it's true that Pedro is very open to the process being a collaboration. And especially in that case, since he has never given birth, he was asking questions to all of us, to the women around that have given birth. So he wanted to know all the details about the different ways that it could happen, different things that could go wrong. What about epidural or no epidural? Because I was asking him all those questions, like, we need to know specifics, you know, like, I think I even wanted to know, like, how much are they dilated, like, in the conversation in the room before the next scene where they are already pushing, like, and I think that was a little too extreme for him, like, I need to know, like, such specific details, but in my mind, you know, I needed to be really clear about like what moment of the process I was in, when the contractions are still happening like every few minutes. It's not like when they happen very, very like one after another, when you are closer to the time where you have to push. So yeah, there were a lot of conversations about that.
Did you draw on a lot of memories of your births when you were making that scene?
It's true that I try not to mix my own experiences that are related to people that I love in my life, but it's impossible not to. I try not to force it. I try like not to force the exercise of imagining your own kids or your own partner or your own mother or father in situations. I don't like doing that, but it's true that that window is always open. And if it's not forced and things come through, I think it can be okay. As long as it's not used in a manipulative way, especially with my kids, I feel like that's sacred. It's a separate thing from any fiction. But of course, like you said, doing a scene when I'm giving birth, it was a very strong day where a lot of things like in my body, in my cells, were remembering what I went through. And it was very emotional because of that reason.
The movie also portrays just like the physical bond between a mother and her child, and the experience of like touching a newborn baby and then continuing to like hold the baby after you take the baby home, and what that feels like the touch. How do you express that on camera? How do you express that emotion? That it's so interior.
Yeah, but it's the strongest feeling that I have experienced. And it's true that when we were shooting and I saw the face of this little baby that was so tiny, of course, in that moment, I revisit all the emotions that I experienced in my own, the birth of my kids, which is like that first moment when you look at each other and you see those eyes and that soul and you feel like, oh, you already know that person. You cannot imagine your life without that person, even if you just met them. But I don't think you just met them. And I'm not talking only about the 9 months of pregnancy. You just feel like they've been forever with you, a part of you. So, yeah, that was like probably the most emotional moment in the scene, is when they put the real baby on top of me.
Do you think being a mother has changed your acting or your range of emotions?
I think it has changed everything in me, the way I see life, the way I feel things, the way I can never think about myself first, and the way it affects my work, for sure, because I live everything even with more intensity. I used to be working nonstop, like since I was 17 or 18 until late in my 30s when I became a mother. And I was doing 3 movies per year, 4 movies per year, some of them very long, traveling nonstop. But I changed that rhythm when I became a mother, because my priority is to be with them and to raise them, and I just don't want to miss anything that goes on with them. So I feel very fortunate and very blessed, very lucky that I can continue to have my career combining my work with my most important mission, which is being a good mom.
So I want to quote something that Pedro Almodóvar says in the press kit for Parallel Mothers. He said, and I quote, "Directing her, Penelope Cruz, directing her has been a meticulous process where I needed her to surrender herself to me as if in a state of hypnosis. I contained the flood of tears. Penelope is very emotional, and she would have been crying from start to finish, and she knew how to replace the tears with the exact amount of guilt and shame in a state of constant alarm." What does it mean when he says he wanted you to surrender yourself to him as if in a state of hypnosis?
Well, I always do that when I'm working with him. Sometimes when I'm working with other directors and they don't want to rehearse, they don't want to block time to rehearse, or for whatever reason it doesn't happen because you go from one movie to the next. And I take the time to prepare with my acting teacher, and I love that time of research. But I don't work with my acting teacher when I'm with Pedro, because I arrive to the set like empty, from zero. I read the story, I start, of course, I cannot stop thinking about it after I read it, and I come with proposals or ideas of how I see it, but I come like really open to listen and to understand what he wants, because he will give us that time. He give us, like, in this movie, it was like 4 months or more of rehearsals. And it was very necessary in this case, because Milena and I, we were so touched and affected by the script and the characters and what happens to them, that we would start reading a scene with Pedro and we would immediately start crying. And we could not control it. It was just moving so much inside of us. And he said, "That's fine. I know we have to go through this process, but those are your own tears and they are not the ones of the characters." And in my case, for Janice, we express ourselves in very different ways. My character is more, in a situation like the one she goes through, I would be crying like 20 times a day, but she doesn't. She doesn't. She expresses that in a very different way. And to get to that point where I could be able to do some of those scenes without exploding, without crying, without expressing those emotions in a way that is more familiar to me, that took time. That took time to just like go through things and digest things, because Pedro has constructed something that it's almost a thriller sometimes. It's almost film noir. It's almost like it's such an incredible adrenaline ride. He could not have gotten that if all of us would have been in a state of, I cannot say despair, because they are desperate, but the way they express it, there cannot be a release in form of tears until that block in the movie where she decides to make a confession.
I want to talk with you about another theme in the movie, and that is a much more political theme. And it has to do with reckoning with the legacy of the Spanish Civil War, in which the fascists won, leading to a decades-long dictatorship of Francisco Franco. How political was your family when you were growing up? Because you were born the year before Franco died, so you didn't live under his dictatorship, but your family did, and everybody older than you did.
I was born in 74, and I mean, the rest of the 70s, too young to remember. But in the 80s, there was really like a feeling in the air of like chains for freedom of expression. Like what happened to me, and I don't say this because it sounds good because of my relationship with Pedro. This is very real. When I was in the 80s, and I started to discover Pedro's films and watch some of his interviews. Not so much the part of the Movida, you know, that I also didn't experience because I was very young, but to hear his message, I always saw him as much more than an amazing director, a genius director, but much more than that, because I remember being very little and asking myself, feeling this man could be and should be our president. You know, I would remember like being a little girl and seeing him also as some kind of political figure, because it was so necessary to have somebody like that in those years, that through art and through his message was inspiring that freedom and those values.
Yeah, can I just interrupt and say that he was a major part of what was known as La Movida, which was like the movement. And this was like after Franco's death, when artists were no longer going to be censored, there was this like outburst of new creative, lively art that my understanding is, I know when I talked to Antonio Banderas, who's also worked with Almodovar, he talked about how this movement had like punk rock and sexuality, joy, color, LGBTQ characters, and Almodovar was famous for that. You know, he was one of the first filmmakers to have LGBTQ characters being just people, not like this is a problem or this is an issue. They were just like people in the film.
Exactly, and that's maybe what I mean by that even if I was not part of the Movida, and Movida was a part of it, was really crazy, but there was something else behind it that was his message and what he was doing through his art that was like so respectful and inclusive and revolutionary, you know, for those years in our country. Maybe just not in our country, for the world, to have somebody that speaks his mind like that, and what he has done with women from the beginning, their respect and adoration to women, the understanding of women, because he has been raised by very strong, incredible women, the mother, the sisters, the neighbors, and he has been observing them, you know, as a little kid, always observing like the secret conversations and the behavior. And so I was a little girl, but I was picking up all those things in him.
You wanted to meet Almodovar so badly. You wanted to be in his films. You used to, when you were young, I don't know how old, you can tell me, you used to stand outside of his home, I guess hoping to catch a glimpse of him. Did you see him when you would, how old were you? Did you see him when you were doing that? And did he see you? Did he think you were a stalker?
No, I mean, the first time I was really obsessed with his films. So sometimes I would go to the cinema or to a bar, to a place, and I would say to my friends, we're going to see Almodóvar today. I have a feeling. And they were like, oh, here you go with your like intuition thing, blah, blah, blah. And then he would walk in the door. And this happened like two or three times with him. But we would not talk because we didn't know each other, and I was too shy to come up to him and say anything. And then he saw my first two movies and he called me, and I was drying my hair at home, and somebody told me Almodóvar is on the phone. And I, of course, I thought it was a joke because it was such a particular, specific dream that I've had for so many years. And they said, no, he is waiting on the phone. It's true. So I picked up the phone, and from hello, I felt like, oh, this was my longtime friend that I had not seen in a while. And we connected in an incredible way. He called me to go to his house to read some scenes for his next film. But he told me I was too young because I was always lying about my age at that point, saying that I was older. And he said, I will write to you another character in another film soon. And he put it in writing. He gave me a letter, beautiful letter. And then he called me for Lifeless. And Lifeless, even if it was 10 minutes in the film, it opened so many doors for me.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
No, I thank you. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Penelope Cruz stars in Pedro Almodóvar's new film, Parallel Mothers. After we take a short break, our film critic Justin Chang will tell us his favorite movies of the year, and we'll hear from actor Alan Cumming. His memoir, Baggage, is bracketed by his first marriage to his wife and his second marriage to his husband. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. It's that time again when we ask our film critic Justin Chang to tell us about his favorite movies of the year. Here's Justin.
2021 was the year that some of us returned to movie theaters, cautiously but gratefully. After a year spent watching screeners at home, it was wonderful to see great new movies on the big screen again. And there were great movies. So many that, as usual, I had trouble narrowing my year-end list down to 10. And so here are my 11 favorite movies of 2021, which, per my annual tradition, I've arranged as a series of grouped titles. I do this because it never ceases to amaze me how every year, so many of my favorite movies seem to be in conversation with each other. The best movie I saw this year was Drive My Car, an extraordinarily moving drama from the Japanese writer and director Ryusuke Hamaguchi. It's been winning critics' prizes left and right, and it deserves them. This adaptation of a Haruki Murakami short story about a widowed theater actor and director and the relationship he forges with his personal driver is a profound meditation on how art can and can't compensate for some of life's disappointments. My next two favorite movies are also about the challenge of making art in the aftermath of intense grief. The Souvenir Part 2 is the second chapter of Joanna Hogg's semi-autobiographical drama about her days as a film student in 1980s London. It opens in the wake of her boyfriend's untimely death and somehow evolves into one of the most joyous portraits of cinema as a collaborative medium that I've ever seen. At number 3 on my list is a haunting documentary called Procession, in which the director Robert Greene follows 6 men, all survivors of childhood sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, as they make a series of short films about the trauma they endured. It isn't easy to watch, but it's a powerful portrait of male friendship and solidarity in the face of unspeakable evil. My next two favorites are both gorgeous films that completely transported me when I saw them on the big screen. At number 4 is Memoria, the latest from the critically beloved Thai director Apichatpong Wirasatakul. It stars Tilda Swinton as a botanist in Colombia, where she sets out to solve a mystery that builds to the strangest, most jaw-dropping movie moment I experienced this year. At number 5 is Days, a ravishing portrait of a fateful brief encounter between two lonely men. The story couldn't be simpler, but the Taiwanese-Malaysian director Tsai Ming-liang films it with such tenderness that it might just bring you to tears. And speaking of tears, at number 6 on my list is Parallel Mothers, a multi-layered melodrama featuring a possibly career-best performance by Penelope Cruz. It's also the best movie in years from the great Spanish director Pedro Almodovar, here working at a new level of mastery. My number 7 movie, Petite Maman, from the French director Céline Sciamma, is a much quieter, gentler story about mothers and daughters. It runs just 72 minutes, and does more in that compact running time than some movies manage in their entirety. Up next on my list are two stories about men trying and failing to live up to the destinies they've envisioned for themselves. At number 8 is The Disciple, in which the Indian director Chaitanya Tamhani follows a young man who aspires to be a great Hindustani classical singer, but simply doesn't have greatness in him. That makes it an ideal pairing with The Green Knight, David Lowery's bewitching Arthurian epic, starring Dev Patel. It's a wonderful subversion of the usual heroic quest narrative, and a reminder that we often learn more from our failures than we do from our triumphs. The last two movies on my list are both tense, suspenseful dramas about the deceptiveness of appearances. At number 10 is The Power of the Dog, Jane Campion's magnificent Western psychodrama, starring a fearsome Benedict Cumberbatch as a Montana rancher who isn't entirely what he seems. And at number 11 is Passing, Rebecca Hall's striking directing debut, starring Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga as two light-skinned black women living on different sides of the color divide in 1920s New York. These are stories about what it means to live a lie, but like all my favorite movies this year, they're full of emotional truth.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. You can find his list at freshair.npr.org. My next guest, Alan Cumming, has written a new memoir in which he explains that at some of his greatest career highs, he's been unhappy and confused. At his most celebrated, he's felt the lowest self-esteem. He traces some of this to his relationship with his father, who tormented him psychologically and beat him. Cumming also writes about his two marriages and his understanding of his own sexuality. In his 20s, he was married to a woman. Their relationship lasted about 8 years. He's been with his husband for 17 years. Cumming's memoir is also filled with insights about acting. Cumming became famous in the U.S. for his Tony Award-winning performance in the 1998 Broadway revival of Cabaret. He played the MC in a Berlin nightclub in 1929 and 30, as the Nazis are gaining power, but people in the Cabaret are oblivious to what that means. Cumming's interpretation of the character emphasized the sexuality and debauchery of the club's culture. In 2014, that production was revived, with Cumming again playing the MC. Cumming was nominated for 3 Emmys and 2 Golden Globes for his performance in the TV series The Good Wife. His movies include the Kubrick film Eyes Wide Shut, the Bond film Golden Eye, the X-Men film X2, and the Spy Kids trilogy. His cabaret act, Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs, was broadcast on PBS. He co-starred in the recent series Schmigadoon, a loving spoof of musicals from the 1940s and 50s. Let's start with the opening song from Cabaret.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. Fremda, étranger, stranger. Glücklich zu sehen, je suis enchanté. Happy to see you, bleib, rest, stay. Welcome, bienvenue. Welcome in cabaret, oh cabaret, oh cabaret. Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies and Gentlemen, guten Abend, bonsoir.
Alan Cumming, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
So you came to New York to do Cabaret. And you say that it was an unusual feeling to not have people make assumptions about your class or about your intelligence because you were Scottish. What were the assumptions in Britain about you because of your accent?
Yeah, I before I came to New York, I was living in London. And, you know, there's quite a lot of baggage, as it were, being a Scot living in London, being from outside of the southeast of England and living you know, and coming to live in London. It's not just about Scottish people. Irish people get it. People who from the north of England get it too. But there's you know, the class system in Britain is pretty still incredibly vivid, and also the whole kind of nationality thing. The sort of, you know, there was a sort of ancient historical persecution of Scotland by the English over the years. So what it meant to me, though, personally, was that how I sounded would mean that people would assume things about my education, my intelligence, my class. And they were always not, you know, very positive things in their minds. So when I came to America, when I came to New York, I didn't really realize all this when I was living in London. It was just part of this sort of subliminal thing that you just had to deal with. It was part of what it was like living in London. And so when I came to New York, that's when I realized, because I was being sort of celebrated for all the things that I was slightly derided for as a Scot in London. People liked my voice. People liked how I thought. People liked that I was different. And that's when I kind of realized that I'd been living with that, and that Scottish people live with that, and just because of where they're from when they come down south.
We talked a lot about Cabaret in our 2014 interview, so I don't want to go over the same territory. But I was really interested to read in the book that when you were first offered Cabaret, you declined. You didn't want to be in a musical. Why didn't you want to be in a musical?
I just felt, I mean, I was being snobby, I suppose. I just didn't quite, I just felt musicals weren't for me. It was very much, you know, I hadn't done anything like that. I'd sort of, even the sort of stand-up comedy act that I did where we sang, we kind of were parodying and slightly looking down on that sort of, you know, and taking the mickey out of musicals in a way. I just felt it was not my thing. I saw musicals as something light, and I was, you know, I was a serious actor. I was literally doing Hamlet right before I did the MC. So I think it was just my youthful arrogance, I suppose, and also slight, and also fear. But luckily Sam Mendes sort of, you know, persuaded me, and I realised that my fear about doing a show like Cabaret, which is about a very serious subject, doing that in the form of a musical, which by its very nature has to have certain tropes that to me can sometimes demean the material, that was my worry. And that was also, Sam had thought about that through and thought that through. And, you know, the production that we both wanted to do the same thing, I guess, which was do this very kind of gritty, earthy production. And also, Cabaret is a good musical in that there's a reason why you burst into song, certainly for my character, because he's a performer in a club. So it's not quite, I mean, I still have trouble with, you know, I'm talking now and now I'm singing. I still have trouble with that. And when I'm trying to be sort of, you know, when I can do it in a sort of a parody way, in a way that's heightened. But if I'm trying to be a real person, I still have some problems with that. I'm working on it, though.
Were you comfortable singing in character?
Yes. I singing in character is much easier. You have this sort of veil of the character between you and the audience. I find it really difficult. And, you know, I started doing my own concerts about 10 years ago or so. And that was a huge, terrifying leap to suddenly sing as me. And I'm so glad. I love it now, and I'm really glad I've done it. And I do these concerts all over the place. And it's been an incredible thing for my confidence and for my, and also the way that I sort of want to, you know, what I want to talk about. Each show sort of has a theme. The one I'm doing currently is about sort of aging. It's called Alan Cummings Not Acting His Age. I feel I can actually say things that I want to say, using the sort of medium of cabaret, a true cabaret of, you know, talking about stuff, singing a song that kind of illustrates that, making people think, making people laugh, making people cry. That is, I'm really glad I'm doing that. But it was very, very, very scary to step outside a character and say, this is me.
Your first memoir had a lot to do with your childhood growing up and your father's emotional and physical abuse. I mean, he tormented you. He beat you. You still write about some of that in your new memoir. And you tell this really horrible story about being locked in this tube. Your father was a forester. Can you give us the short version of that story?
It's a thing called a Selcure plant. It was a thing that would, a little sort of railway would go into this big metal tube and then with it had wood on these little trolleys, and then it would, they would sort of vacuum seal this big tube, and then all this.
This was to like cure the wood with some kind of chemical, right?
To make it more hard wearing and to last, you know, for like sort of that sort of green color you see wood and sort of fence posts and things have, and so what happened was that the one time the little chains that kept the wood on the little trolleys broke and the wood kind of fell out. And so the thing was blocked. It couldn't come out. And so my job was, I was little, I had to crawl along the edge of this slimy, green, chemically tube and kind of try and pull the blocked wood out. And my, when I was inside doing that, I had said to my dad, please don't shut the door. Because I was really scared he was going to shut the door on me. And he did. He shut this big door and I was suddenly in the dark and all this big sort of chemical, you know, prison. And he just did it as a joke, just to be funny. And but that's, I write about that in this book as a way to just say I still, that's one of my nightmares that I have, a recurring nightmare I have, that I was, that he, you know, he then, he opened the door again and I dream that he's going to lock the door and I'm going to be drowned in this, in all this Selkirk chemical. So I write about, I mean, I in my first book, I talked in a lot of detail about my childhood. In this book, I sort of talk about the shadow of it, I think, and that, and also the fact that after writing the first memoir, I sort of, in some way, foolishly thought that I would have some sort of closure or something with my dad. But actually, of course, he came back into my life in a way, a much more vivid and present way than ever before. And I actually realise now that is for, that is as it should be. He is my father, but he's in my life now on my terms. And I just wanted to kind of talk back a little at the notion from the first memoir that somehow I was cured and overcome and I triumphed all my sort of childhood abuse. And I feel I want to say, no, you still have it. I still have these dreams. I still have things that trigger me. And I feel that you just, the most important thing is never to deny what's happened to you.
I'm just thinking about how not funny and how very cruel it was of your father to lock you in, however briefly, in this tube, you know, this big canister filled with a chemical. And now that we know so much more about the toxic qualities and the long-lasting toxic qualities of many chemicals, I mean,
there's nothing good about it. Yeah,
no, it's just a horror show.
It's a horror. I mean, and that was one of many sort of similar. I mean, it wasn't just physical. You know, he was violent, but it was also like that. He did, you know, these really weird sort of sick kind of games and. You're right. He tormented me and my brother.
How aware was your mother of what your father was doing, and how did she handle it? And I'm wondering if he's been dead a few years. So when you say he's a presence in your life, you mean like a psychological presence. He's not a physically living presence anymore. But your mother is still alive.
My mother's very much alive and kicking. Yes, I saw her yesterday. What I meant about my dad is he's more, I mean, I'm talking about him now. You know, I talk about him. He's much more present in, when I do interviews now, it's, you know, because I did sort of come out, as it were, as someone who had an abusive childhood. I feel that's very much a part of my identity. And I feel I've welcomed him back in, or allowed him back in. I was sort of in denial about him for a long time. I sort of didn't even remember many of the things that happened to me. So my mum, you know, we all lived in terror. I mean, if you live in terror, it's a sort of paralyzing thing. There was nothing any of us could have done. We lived in fear of our lives. And I think she eventually got away from my dad, and I really admire her. I really admire the kind of, you know, she's a survivor too, and she made a life for herself and went on to find happiness with someone else. And I think that's sort of, you know, testament to her character and her strength.
You were already out of the house when she did that.
Yeah, I left, you know, when I was 17, I went to drama school as quickly as I could. I sort of fled And it, you know, I took, but it was very many years after that before I could even remember things or even countenance the idea of sort of confronting my own past, my own memories. It was, in a way, my body was protecting me from, I think, from, I was too little and too young to process the what was happening to me. It was too, I shouldn't, you know, a child shouldn't have to deal with that. So I think my body kind of just said, okay, we're not going to actually deal with that right now. We're going to just store that away somewhere. And then when it was, when I was starting to try to become a father myself, I feel that's when my, that unlocked all those memories about my own father.
When those memories started coming back to you, did you trust the memories? And was there anybody who you could talk to who could say, yeah, that really happened?
The person that I was able to be reassured by that it had happened was my brother. And I, but of course, I think if anyone has had experience of remembering abuse and that you can't believe it happened, you can't, saying it aloud is just seems, so you have to, I mean, it's really important to be believed. Partly because you can't believe it yourself, and actually saying it, you know, a good abuser relies on you protecting them because you are so ashamed of what's happening to you. So actually finally being saying this happened to me is such a huge maelstrom of emotion. And so it is very important to be believed. And if people doubt you, or as happened to me, because I was leaving a relationship whilst all that was going on, to, you know, to sort of hurt you, to sort of say that they're, that it's not true and that I was making it up, that that was very, very difficult.
Well, you're right about that. You didn't talk to your father for about 16 years, but you mentioned that you and your brother returned to see your father and to confront him. What did you say to each other? Can, are you comfortable talking about that?
I wrote it all down, what I wanted to say. And I said, you know, we remember these incidents of violence and abuse, and we listed some of the things, and we, I mean, I obviously I was getting a lot of therapy at the time, and I tried not to be too sort of, you know, therapy speak with him. I tried to say, I want to understand why you did that, and if there was something, do you think there's something that happened to you that made you behave in that way? And you know, we did all that, and I just felt, I said, the reason we are here today is to give you this back. We have carried this thing that didn't belong to us, and we feel, we understand that it happened now, but we want to give it back to you, and to take it all out in the open, say that it happened, and see if we can continue having a relationship. But if we're going to continue, you have to come back with us, to us, willing to discuss this, and willing to sort of explain, it's happened now, it's never not going to happen, but maybe you could make it clearer for us why you think it happened, what was going on in your life, and maybe, you know, you tell, let us know if you actually still want to be in our lives. So we did that in a very, you know, we thought about it a lot, and it was a terrifying experience because we were having this conversation in the place where we had had the abuse. And we went for a walk around the estate, actually, to not be in the house. And it was scary. I thought my dad was going to hit me at one point. And at the end, when we drove away, I could see he had tears in his eyes, and we sort of left the door open for him. And my brother said this hilarious thing to me, like, when we got in the car, and we were both just shaking, and, you know, it was an incredible experience. And he said to me, gosh, Alan, you hardly looked at the script at all. That's what he said to me, because I had this piece of paper with all the things I wanted to say. And he made it like I was acting a scene, which I thought was kind of perfect, actually. But then we never heard from him again. The next time I heard from my father was many years later, when he got in touch via my brother to tell me that I wasn't his biological son. That was the next time I heard from him.
But you did some research and DNA testing, and you found out that
I was his son. Yeah, I was his son. So I had to.
Why did he say that you were not his biological son? Did he believe that?
he totally believed it. And it was fascinating. I mean, you know, it was very difficult and emotional and just insane to actually, when it was happening. But now, you know, looking back at it, it's kind of fascinating that at some point he made something that was maybe a little niggly thing, a little sort of suspicion, into the truth for him. I think partly to justify in his mind the way he was behaving to my mother in terms of the affairs he was having, and also to me in terms of, but it doesn't quite make sense because, you know, he hit my brother as well. The logic of it is not quite clear, but he, you know, I had the last time I spoke to him, I called him up and said, I have got the results of the DNA test. I am your son. And he said, I mean, imagine having that conversation. And he said, well, I'm very surprised to hear that. And I was like, I bet you are. And he said to me, he said things like, I had to believe it, Alan. I said, no, you didn't. You chose to believe it. And he said things like, you know, did you not notice that we never bonded? I was like, yes, oh, believe me, I noticed. It was just like I was dealing with a child. And I eventually had to say to him, you know, I'm going to stop this conversation now and I won't talk to you again. We won't be speaking again. It's really difficult because you can't expect rationality from an irrational person. Or, I mean, I think he was mentally ill. I think he had certain personality disorders and goodness knows what happened to him when he was a little boy. He certainly didn't break the cycle, I think. But it was crazy.
When you were a teenager and decided you wanted to act and started studying drama, was it a relief to get out of yourself and become other people?
Yes. Yes, it was. And I think that's still something that I feel is, you know, a great attraction for me about acting. I just love the idea that I play someone completely different to myself. I think obviously then it was more about the fact that if I dwelt too much on my present, I mean, I kind of wasn't doing that. I was kind of just not processing it. I was just moving through it, trying to just being quite blinkered. But the idea of being someone else, being someone completely different, was very liberating and fun and, you know, and easy. So, yeah, that was a great thing.
You know, you write in your memoir about your marriage to your wife, who you married when you were in your 20s, I think. And then,
yeah, 21.
Your marriage to your husband, and you've been together for about 17 years. You say that, you know, after you were married for a while, you realized that you needed to make a change, that you needed to get out of the marriage, but you weren't really sure how to do it. And you also were going through a really rough period. Correct me if I have the chronology wrong here. But there was a period when you were doing Hamlet at night and rehearsing Cabaret during the day, which was two extraordinary roles, but it turned out to be a very kind of dangerous brew for you because of the characters. What was seeping into your person from their characters that added to your depression and anxiety during that period?
Well, Hamlet, I was playing someone who is having, you know, very difficult time with his family, who is being, being asked to confront things about his dad. I was in Hamlet with, and the actress playing Ophelia was also my wife. In Cabaret, I was being sort of, I guess, having to mine my fantasies in terms of what the character would do sexually and things like that. There was just a lot going on. And I also at the time was trying to become a father. I mean, the real sort of the thing that precipitated my sort of breakdown was that, was unleashing all those memories from my childhood. But playing those two parts, you're first of all exhausted, but also there's sort of certain kind of, you know, things that are unleashed because of what you're dealing with. I didn't leave the work at home. I didn't leave work at the theatre. I took it home. I took the sort of angst and the despair of Hamlet home with me, and that was a disaster. I learned that lesson, but it was a very, very difficult lesson to learn.
I think it must have been really complicated to be thinking, do I really want to be a father? Do I even really want to stay in this marriage? Well, at the same time, playing opposite your wife every night on stage because you were Hamlet and yeah. She was Ophelia.
Yeah, it was a hot mess. It was a total yeah. hot mess.
Yeah.
And really, it was just, you know, and then suddenly saying to someone, you know, who you've been very assiduously trying to get pregnant with, suddenly saying, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. In fact, I don't even know if I want to be with you. I don't know why. I'm just feeling really weird and depressed and incapable of choosing my clothes in the morning. I mean, it was just, and also not eating. That was another thing. It kind of had a sort of burgeoning eating disorder around about that time. So it was just, one of the things about writing about yourself is, you know, and going back and researching, because I felt such compassion for my younger self. I really, you know, I was several times thinking, oh my God, you poor little thing. That was a lot to deal with.
Thank you so much for coming back to our show. I really enjoyed speaking with you again.
It's always lovely to be probed by you, Terry.
I like the way you said that.
Mercilessly probed.
It sounds like a horrible visit to the doctor's office. Alan Cumming, thank you again.
Thank you.
Alan Cumming's new memoir is called Baggage. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.